Welcome to Red Eyes Radio. I'm Henrik. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm here with Lana from Radio 314. And, well, we just returned from the MPI conference in Washington, D.C. And we had a great time, I must say. A lot of good people, a lot of good folks there. A lot of, actually positive attitudes. And I think those who didn't attend really did miss out, whether or not you agree with every little nuance of the different speakers or not. But it was a great moral booster, actually, for people who are concerned with the kinds of topics addressed, during the conference. So I just want to say, thanks to everyone who came out and to everyone who we met and had the pleasure of shaking hands with, and all those we didn't have the time to meet as well, because there was just so many people there. So anyway, we did this live podcast during the event, or panel discussion with some audience questions that we're going to tune into today, listen to as today's show. I thought you might enjoy that. I think it was a lot of fun. It was actually quite good and a good way of doing things to get some audience participation as well. But what do you think, Lana? What's your thoughts on the whole thing?
Well, like I told John Friend, I thought the gathering was highly significant because it was the first alt-right conference where about half the attendees were under 30. They were not only young, but they were also intelligent. They were funny, edgy, well-dressed, and actually pretty handsome, shattering that Hollywood-created stereotype of what it means to be a proud white man or woman in 2015. Mm-hmm. And as I looked around at the conference, I could see about, 200 people. And I saw a true opposition to this liberal decay with the energy and the creativity that I think will attract many in the coming years. So as I said on Twitter, I encourage a lot of you young girls to get there next year to get matched up with some of these young guys.
Yeah, why not? It's important. We need the babies, folks. Let's get going.
Yeah, and I thought it was also a lot of fun for me to see live Mike Enoch, Richard Spencer, and you, of course, because you're all three such different personalities, yet you align in all the important issues. So that made the interaction fun to watch. And I, however, was kind of losing my voice and a little tired, so it's kind of a blur.
No, you did great. Yeah, don't worry about it. I think everyone's probably a little tired doing these kinds of events. It's really exciting, and it's a lot of, as I said, a lot of good people there, but you... If you're not accustomed to it in that way of that, multitude of interactions that you do, you can get a little bit overwhelmed in some cases. And many people they're kind of up late, and they were, some were drinking and stuff. So they're probably a little hungover and just tired because of that, for that reason. So
yeah, it's intense if you don't go out often, and then bam, you're in a room with 200 people or you hit it off with everyone and you want to talk with everyone.
Exactly. Yeah. It gets, but it's great though. I mean, it's fantastic. So yeah, it was a great time. As I said, everyone was happy with it. So yeah, we just want to say, thank you to Richard Spencer for having us there. It was a great time, as I said. And it was a great venue. It was very professional done. A lot of good things all around with it. So we're just very happy with it. So yeah, let's switch over to the live podcast, see what was going on.
Let's do it.
Well, welcome to Become Who We Are. Let's go down the line and introduce ourselves. In this first ever group podcast, my name is Richard Spencer.
My name is Henrik Palmgren, behind Red Eyes Creations, Red Eyes Radio.
Yeah, that's deserving of a round of applause.
I'm Lana. I have a show called Radio 314, also on the Red Eyes Network.
Check. Yeah, Mike, I have a podcast on therightstuff.biz, my website. Some of you guys might know it. And we have a number of podcasts. We're starting a sort of little podcast network on that site. So go and check us out over there.
Thanks a lot. So I guess I'll start off. I was a little disappointed in our social justice warrior enemies. I really was expecting them to just totally go nuts, and they kind of disappointed me.
Yeah, I mean, there was like, 4 guys out there?
I had to get here very early. They were spraying some kind of party spray. It was almost like, thanks.
Yeah, I saw one guy, and he was yelling, fascist scum, and he looked like a total homeless scumbag. Talking to guys are looking pretty slick and pretty hot in their suits, so...
Well, as I was walking in, this guy was fat. He is unshaven, slovenly, he's filthy, sloppy, and he's telling me, you obviously hate yourself. And I'm like, really, dude? Like, I don't know. SJWs always project. So there we go.
Yeah, amazing. So where are you guys coming from? Mike, you came down from New York City?
Yeah, I did. That's right.
Awesome. And so you are based out of Sweden, but you're in the United States.
Yeah, we go back and forth a little bit. So usually majority of time in Sweden and then a little bit on the East Coast in the U.S. as well.
Have you experienced anything to do with the refugee crisis firsthand?
I've seen it up close in the town where I'm from. Actually, I've lived for many years in where this gentleman who actually did this sword attack at the school.
Oh, wow.
It's a town called Trollhättan.
See, that's the kind of stuff I want. I want sword attacks. I don't want any more party spray. My life is just getting boring. I want sword axe, major attacks like this. We need blood.
We got it in Sweden. You know? Well, it's starting to anyway. So, yeah. So anyway, it's evident that it's happening for sure in Sweden, and I think it's just a initial step of what is to come. Basically, there's no other way out of this. Politicians are not listening, and this guy, this young kid, really, he did write a note of sorts saying that this was due to, he's critical of immigration. He sees that he's targeted this school specifically for that reason. And, as desperate of an act that this is, I think he probably felt that this was his only way of getting his voice heard to a certain extent, which is extremely sad. And I mean, it's not our side in this that is to... that is responsible or that is here to defend ourselves against any of this. This is the doing of the politicians who refuse to recognize that any of this is ongoing. I mean, this is, they're literally going after people that are complaining that Sweden is being destroyed before our very eyes. And those are the people that are being targeted and have their, in some cases, doors broken down and cops hauling them out of their apartments, So
it's funny because it's one of the things that you always hear from the left that, like... violence is inevitable when you refuse to hear voice of the voiceless or some crap like that. But it's like, again,
it's kind of true.
Who actually doesn't have a voice? Like, do immigrants not have a voice? Do they not have an entire media and elite journalist apparatus to defend their interests and their rights against the native populations whose homes they're usurping? So it's like this kid for real didn't have a voice. Yeah. Like, and if he said something, what would have happened? I'm assuming he was a minor. He probably would have been disciplined at his school or, something. He would have been put in psychotherapy or something like that. So, everyone wants is going to blame us for this, but it's like you created it. This is what you've done. So enjoy it.
I think it also is interesting how this refugee crisis occurring in small towns. And I mean, the best example was that crazy German example, which seems almost like too ridiculous, as if we made it up or something. They're like a village of 400 people and there's 1,000 immigrants. But I mean, one thing, the American example and the American experience really has been this, let's just flee to the frontier, effectively. Let's go to the burbs and just get away from it all. And so there's Whitopia all across the United States. There's ways that you don't really experience it. And I think in some ways these people, like where I live for half of the year in Montana, I almost forgive their naivete because they've literally never met a black person. But I think something really different is occurring in Europe. I think what's happening is it's accelerated. It's going to be much more radical.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It's horrendous. I think that, unfortunately, more of this is to come because there's no other... I mean, sure, the Sweden Democrats, many other parties around Europe are obviously gaining for this reason. But, as Guillaume pointed out, too, it's not, is it radical enough? Is it strong enough to a certain extent? Because a lot of these parties just want to basically decrease immigration. But we're only already talking about a demographic suicide, I guess, for lack of a better term, which is, I mean, it's not impossible to turn around, of course. But it seems like it's a monumental task to turn something like this around, and we'll be outnumbered in our own countries in 2-3 generations from now.
Let's talk a little bit about how we came here, because I think that's an interesting conversation. I think we might even get some feedback from the audience. But I actually first started listening to Red Ice Radio just around a year ago. Actually, it was someone in Budapest. It's funny. I wore this suit when I was arrested in Budapest. I have had it cleaned since. but I wore this suit, and then that was the I met a person at the bar at the conference who told me about Red Ice Radio, and I was like, oh wow, it's great. And I probably like listened to everything you put out since then. But if you go back in your catalog, you guys were just all over the place. Oh, I mean, in a good way.
Sure.
So how, and this is also gets back to something that I mentioned in my talk and others, that there's just something happening, and it's not really so much about us. Like it's not like it's you know, I'm the one creating red pilling everyone. They're being red pilled by life. They're being red pilled on Twitter. They're being red pilled by their friends. It's just something is happening amongst people where anyone who has this turn of mind where you want to get at the truth, you want to get the most radical understanding of what's happening, they come to our movement. And so we're dominating the troll wars. You know, I'll pass it on. I found this very interesting thing. There was this, I think it's called Juice Media, so don't mispronounce that. But
that would just be the media then.
It's true. The media loves juice. I mean, they apple, pear, and they did. You know, who is the internet? And they had like Assange there, and they had Edward Snowden, and then they had the kind of troll. Like, in a way, in this conception of this video, that's probably seen by tens of millions of people. Like, we are a quarter of the internet. And I think it's true that we're winning the trolls. It was like in the 1960s, the left won the hippies, they won the hot girls, they won rock and roll. And we don't, we have many beautiful ladies, but we haven't won music yet, although we're trying, but we've won the troll war. That's amazing.
Well, it's funny because, you know, there's this site I know a lot of people know about, 4chan and Poll, and everyone knows about it, whether or not you participate in it. And, you know, things have happened. But there's another thing on a site called 8chan that's called Lefty Poll. And, like, these people have the pretense as, like, leftist, socialist, communist, social justice warriors that they can be politically incorrect. And they can't be. There's no way that you can be political, and this is the thing. It's like, and then there's this phenomena that you see in the media and in TV shows that pretend to be edgy, and they make, you know, really graphic sexual humor and things like that, and they'll talk about race, but they're making fun of talking about race, and that's the pretense of political incorrectness. And we're the ones that are actually politically incorrect. I mean, you can't be a rebel anymore if you're a leftist. I mean, they've won. They have everything.
Yeah.
They own everything, and they shut down everything. So, you know, if you want to be a rebel, then you have to come over to our side. And that's a really appealing thing, particularly for, I think, young white guys who, like, what do you want to just be? What are you going to be? Like, just some conformist schlub, like, attacking yourself and, you know, weak beta male.
That's
like,
what I want.
It's just completely unappealing. Like, why would you want to be that?
Lana, why don't you talk about your experience? Also, I do want to mention, if you want to take part, please go to the back of the room to the audio table, because we actually have a mic on a short cable. So if you want to ask a question, head over there.
Well, I mean, I already grew up in a family that was politically incorrect, I guess you could say. But they weren't racially aware, but I grew up somewhere really white. So it wasn't actually until I moved down south when I said, I get what this is about, you know, the racial tension and just differences in race and seeing it. And I had traveled all around the world. It just never occurred to me that I have my own racial makeup, my own people that I'm a part of, you know, that I have this whole history that's beyond Christianity, because I grew up in a very Christian home and I felt cheated, like I didn't have real roots to stand on. You know, I have a Slavic history. There's a lot of good symbolism there. There's a lot of good stories there. And I think that if a lot of younger kids had that to stand on, they'd say, wow, this is actually something cool here, you know? And that's what I like about the new right. There's a lot of pagans that are in it. So we're drawing in this other crowd that's not, doesn't have the religious hang-ups, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They're not like, you're not going to go to hell if you have sex, you know, that kind of thing.
Well, but are going to hell.
But they're very, but they're very traditional. It's like, I call it like a radical primordial traditionalism. And I like that because it's anti-feminism, but it's, you know, you want to be married and you want to have kids, but you don't have all that other religious hang-up, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. No, I think we definitely know what you mean. So let's take a questioner. He's a long-time listener, first-time caller.
When we examine the sort of rise of nationalist parties in Europe and then look at Scandinavia in particular, I think the Danes especially sort of stand out with the Danish People's Party in that they've done a really good job holding off this refugee mess, but also that they were effective as a right-wing party and a nationalist party even before this mess started. And I think it's the Danes that stand out in particular among the Nordic countries. Why do you think that is? Why is there such a huge divide between Sweden and Denmark, and even Norway in some sense?
Yeah, it's a good question, one I've been thinking about quite a bit. I think it has something to do with Sweden not winning their independence in a way that Norway especially did, but also Finland and also Denmark. And they, because we were an empire of sorts, a northern empire in the 16, 1700s for a little bit there. And we had Norway and Denmark like disconnecting from us. Sure, Denmark had control over Sweden for a while too, but it's something with the fact that we haven't fought for our territory in a while. We just lost some of the territory. There isn't an appreciation for winning something, gaining something, and holding that. And as an unfortunate consequence to that, we seem to be all too willing to just hand that away. I guess it's indicative a little bit of how I kind of woke up to this too, but it wasn't until, there's a number of issues, I thought about that after you asked me that question on the show there, but it's something with the appreciation for history that is very important in this equation here to wake up to this, that if you don't, that's indicative of our politicians in Sweden, they simply don't know what they're missing. They don't have a concept of what Swedish history is. I genuinely believe that, judging from some of the quotes that I've heard. So it's like they don't know what they're handing away, because to them it doesn't exist, right? So there's nothing there, and that's a difficult question. How do you reach through to that? But anyway, to get back to your question, I think Denmark has been they're more politically incorrect. Thank God. I don't think that their immigration policy is, it is better than Sweden's for sure, but it's still not nearly good or okay. You know, it's still very very poor in that regard. But I think that at least they have an environment where they can discuss things and they can openly talk about this in a way that for some reason Sweden isn't doing. They're very conformist, much, much more conformist than Denmark. So that's a huge problem, obviously. I wish I had a better answer of exactly why, but I think it has to do with the fact that they've fought and they've they won something more recently that we've just lost.
Yeah. Hey, first of all, I'd like to say, I'm a big fan, and honestly, a lot of the talk that we've gone over, it seems that we all agree that a lot of this is information and a cultural war where basically we have to shape an alternative narrative apart from the one that the mainstream is, everybody is pushing. And places like, Poll or The Right Stuff and Red Ice Radio and all these alternative outlets, they really do give people a way to see an alternative viewpoint that no one else really, will present to them. And for now, it's on the internet. But you sort of have to be a little bit politically minded to even, find a Taiwanese cartoon site where, who in their free time decides to go to 8chan? And then find Poll and then find a alt-right broadcast. Don't you think the message has to be spread to other mediums? Like, I don't know if you've heard of Sam Hyde, but he's a comedian.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, some fans in the room, MDE. But I think that's a great example of, branching out into traditional leftist territory, comedy. They're not funny anymore, right? Because
There's nothing how could they be,
right?
They can't talk about anything. There's nothing funny.
Right. Even like Jerry Seinfeld, for Christ's sakes. He's like saying, oh, everyone's too PC. And that's Jerry Seinfeld, right? So, Seinfeld. So, comedy might be another route. I was just wondering, what's your take? What are some other avenues for spreading the message that way?
I think we need to win over these people. I mean, I don't think it's really us doing it or our movement doing it. I just think our movement has to be edgy and radical, and we will get some of these alternative type comedians doing our shit because it's the only stuff that's good. I mean, I think it's interesting just with The Daily Show. I mean, I can confess, just because I hated the Bush administration and the whole war and all that stuff passionately for a while. I mean, I would watch The Daily Show and it was like, oh, finally, someone's making fun of these lunatics. And I think because they were actually opposing someone who was literally in power and using the power of the government to do terrible stuff, there was a kind of edge to The Daily Show. But what is The Daily Show now? It's this like childlike, round-headed mulatto, like he and he'll make fun of some stupid thing Mike Huckabee did. It's like low-hanging fruit to a. Use a metaphor that is, I guess.
Well, I think their ratings are dying.
But yeah, I mean, it's just like there's nothing there. It's not funny. Yeah. You can't, the fool in the court is funny. The guy hired by the king to do entertainment is not funny. It's right. The fool who looks up the skirt of power. That's funny. And that's where we are. So, I mean, we're the left.
Yeah, I mean, in my opinion, comedy is like making fun of people. Like, that's what it is. I mean, yes. That's what's funny, is making fun of people. People are what's funny. Like, objects and stuff aren't really very funny. So you have to be making fun of someone to be funny. Whether it's good-natured or not, it doesn't really matter. You can do both. But the left is all about nobody's feelings can ever be hurt. So there's nothing, there's no avenue for comedy. And, you know, for us, I mean, we just do the podcast. We never expected to get, I think we get like 8,000 listeners a week, but that's just on our channel. It's posted
elsewhere.
It's so
good too, because you say all those naughty words and people are sick and tired. They just want to
cut loose
and just say it how it is.
And we're branching out. Like, we've encouraged other people, do your own shows and promote them in your own ways. And eventually, we just have to build momentum and build listenership, and people come to us. And, if we keep expanding at the rate we're expanding, we'll double again by the end of the year. Who knows if that's going
to
happen.
Yeah. I mean, that's
projecting
what we're
numbers
we're
is always
to.
Dangerous. But.
We want to expand, too, and bring on more people, more videos, more content. I've just started a clothing line because fashion is just a lefty cesspit. Yeah. So I'm kind of going after them, but we got to get into the arts and create our own stuff. You know, screw Hollywood, screw their channels. No. We got to build, and that's what this is about. You know, a lot of people ask me, why aren't there more women? Because generally, society builders have been men, guys that sit and think of the intellectual framework, the infrastructure, that how are we going to do it, the logistics
is generally
men. But once you build it, then the ladies come, That's just always how it works.
I would mention this one thing. I totally agree. I think there's something interesting about our movement, and this is something new. I think this is something that's happened the last 2 years, and I think the right stuff probably deserves more credit than anyone for getting this. But there's almost like this troll hilarity that's almost become like inseparable from our movement. Like, there was a funny article that came out yesterday. I don't know if you guys read it. I tweeted it. But I was interviewed by this webzine called The DCist, and within 3 hours, they have some article up where they actually quote me accurately. I actually can't complain about it at all. But it was just so funny when they talk about us. They're like, these people who, these lame protesters, they actually did a MoveOn.org petition.
Oh.
And
yeah, we paused that pretty hard.
Right. So... they just couldn't. It's like when people think of, the mean old racist or something, it's some staid old, people who are boring and terrible. But with our movement, it's like we're inherently this just hilarious, like maybe even like crazy movement where they're like, we looked at this petition and most of the signers Gimadat Madek.
Or popular in Brooklyn.
Well, here's the thing, like...
Murray Schekelstein. And so they're like, we theorize that some of these names could possibly be pseudonyms. But I, what I find hilarious is just this is almost who we are now. Like this is almost the essence or the aura of the movement.
Isn't it just to like break up this contrived, rigid, weird, you know, angry kind of? I mean, a lot of things have been projected upon, you know, us, if you will, or whatever. But it's a way to absorb those criticisms and adopt them and make them part of our fight to a certain extent. And consequently, in that way, then they don't have anything to throw at us because, you know, that's all they had in their ammunition. And we've absorbed it and we've just made fun of it and we've become that. And I think that's an incredibly important step to be able to move on to something else, to just break through that barrier of nonsense that they're throwing at us.
Yeah. I mean, I think the term the left used for this in the 60s was called culture jamming. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're doing now. And it, you know, it's a first step to break down the basically the complete firewall against of politically correct speech. It's just impenetrable in the mainstream. But the problem with that for them is then it offers no there's nothing interesting or dynamic or funny or engaging in the media anymore. And as content production and consumption goes online, like we're already there, and they can't put stuff online like a petition. Right, because as soon as they put up a petition that's anti-MPI or whatever, you know they know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
Right, and it's completely. I'm not directing it. Like it, they, like my guys, they just do it. Like they're not even mine, but you know my people, my group, my tribe, they just go and of their own accord, and then they're like passing links around. They're like, okay, they're doing this here, they're doing this here. Like we're just going to wreck everything that they do. Like, and you know that it might sound petty, but it. I think it really rustles them a lot. And if they're scared and freaking out, then that's good. Because if they freak out, the more they freak out, the more they reveal themselves.
Yeah. You know, I think Jack Donovan said this, that these people put out this terrible poster where they had all of these pictures. And it would actually almost look like the superheroes of hate.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
It was like
yeah.
Jonathan, Kevin McDonald, you know, like it was like Avengers Assemble, you know. but in a way, that's what it was, and so it has no power because it's actually just kind of like, yeah, that's a great poster.
Well, then Donald Trump supporter would say that.
Right.
We've got a lot of questions.
Oh, good. Let's start taking questions. Yeah.
Okay, back when the election was stolen from Ron Paul twice, I predicted, right. I've been around the alt-right since before it was called the alt-right, when it was quite a bit more dysfunctional. I said it needs to be a lot more middle class before it's going to get anywhere. And when the Ron Paul fiasco happened, I said, we're going to get a bunch of people from there who felt cheated that Ron Paul didn't get elected. I predicted that. And when the right stuff came out, I said, that's the fulfillment of my prediction. I was wondering if you could give me a little bit of history of what triggered you, to use your term, to come to our side, Mike.
Yeah, I mean, partly, I you know, I'll reveal myself as a little bit of a Ron Paul hipster. I was over Ron Paul in 2008, but I was very big in 2007, and then when he lost the primary, like he got like 1% of the vote in the New Hampshire primary in 2008, and I was like, oh, all right. I guess that's failed. And, you know, I went into further, like, dildo forms of, like, anarcho-capitalism and all that crap. But I don't know. That's kind of... It's, like, a very solitary... It's, like, it seems like there's a lot of those guys, but none of them are... Like, I don't know. There's not really a very good community there. And I don't know. Somewhere in the last 4 years, I you know, I found Paul and I found other people, and we just kind of... It just kind of organically happened. But you are right that... Most of the people that were like kind of like core members of TRS were ex Ron Paul guys. So your prediction definitely came true. So you know, confirmation of yeah.
Hi. So some speakers today have touched on nationalist or nativist mainstream parties in European countries like Front National and in Denmark. But it makes me also think of other separatist movements like the Basque separatist movement or Castilian and Scotland and even some things happening in Ukraine. And I wondered if you see connections, similarities, or are these completely other or separate phenomena?
Who wants to take that?
Well, you... Yeah, naturally, of course, they're part of something happening in Europe, a discontent. Even if people don't fully understand what it is or why they're attracted to disconnecting and trying to take back power into their own hands again, absolutely, I think so. And in some cases, of course, it's kind of bizarre, like the Scottish independence vote a while back. Yeah. I mean, they were like complaining on Britain because they didn't have enough immigration. I mean, so what direction do they? I mean, all right, you know. So what are you going to say about that? But there you go. I mean, if that's what they want to do, that can be argued if that's sane or not. But nonetheless, it's indicative of the fact that people are that they're noticing that their world is changing in front of their eyes. They're being dispossessed. They're losing demographics. And even if they're not allowed to talk about it or you know recognize what's happening, they know. I mean, they can see it. The version of reality that the media is presenting does not correspond with what they are experiencing when they are out on the streets or out at a restaurant or whatever. So I think we're going to see much more of that coming, even if it might be negative in the sense that it breaks us apart even more, perhaps, than let's say, Islam within Europe, which is centralized around its belief system. I mean, I think, as you've pointed out, Richard, that there is a huge value in having something of a unification there, of a European. I mean, the European Union in itself is founded on kind of weird ideas by Kalergi and these kinds of things. If people know about that, but the idea is there to help each other out, to do something. I mean, so the tools are in place. We just have to steer it in the right direction. You know?
Yeah, no, I think I totally agree. I mean, I think there is some things happening that even the Scottish Nationalist Party, as stupid as it might have been, it was still an expression of something. And it probably did have a lot of, you know, Anglophobe history to it. But nevertheless, it was expression of some kind of angst. But again, and I guess I'm a dreamer, or you know, the art of the impossible. I think we're Europeans. We're not these little people who want their own little garden. You know, like oh my little garden patch, and out by the barn, we're gonna secede and have our little ethno state. No, I mean we should be an empire. I mean the thing that the current masters of the universe fear is a superpower on the level of a European empire. That is something that could confront them. That's something that could defeat them. And I just think at some point, we as Europeans have to come to this realization. And I think conservatives in general, it's not so much about always limiting government or saying we need less power, let's do this. No, we need more power. We need to embrace power at some point.
At the same time, we shouldn't rebel. You know, we should encourage separatist groups. I mean, I came from an anarchist background, then I woke up to race, and I was like, oh, shoot, we need something solid to actually protect ourselves here, because these incoming people, they don't care about your free market societies and your anarchist utopia, you know? I mean, if they were to come in, then all we'd be doing is fighting all day, you know? We wouldn't be able to have our organic garden and homeschool our children and whatnot, but I mean, I support separatist movements of all kinds, like Keith, even if they're communists, because I don't want to live with communists. At the end of the day, I don't want to live with all these lefties either, you know? So we should support separation, a divorce. I am all for that. So you can have whatever political system you want, just don't live with us. We're nationalists. We're new right. Keep it away, you know? That's how I feel.
I'd like to just add one other thing that, you know, when I hear people talk about like these, like, I don't know anything about the Basque people, right? Like, I'm sorry. I'm sure they're wonderful. I'm sure they're tremendous, wonderful people. But like, I hear a lot of...
They love me.
They love me. I've done things for them. But I hear a lot of people, and I think this is something that sort of afflicts, I think, what some Western youth, particularly on the left, and then when they go to college, they get really interested in like the Palestinian struggle or the struggle of the Huzi Watsits in somewhere. And I'm always like, you know, that's to me, it's like they're outsourcing their feelings of wanting some kind of identity and struggle. So they just need to, and you know, I like the term taking our own side. They need to take their own sides. Don't worry so much about some little tribe in like the middle of Brazil or something like that. Worry about us.
I'm just curious if a few of you could share maybe like one success story and one failure story of convincing people outside of this movement that you're not just 100% evil sociopathic for being part of this.
Is that to anybody or?
Yeah.
I'll briefly talk about this because I've already talked about it, but. I guess I would count a successful ideological warfare actually when I was attacked in Montana. Mm-hmm. It actually arose due to a journalist that I just saw again today. But I don't know where to begin. It arose with this truly horrible man named Randy Schuneman, whom the fates put me on a chairlift with this... big, bearded, obese, just awful human being. And I basically made fun of him to his face. But I don't really regret it, to be honest, because he needed to hear it from a friend. No, he needed to hear it. Then this became some story, of gossip story in the Daily Beast or something, for reasons I have no earthly idea. There must be some connection. And then that triggered a story in the local paper, and then this brought out of the woodwork this man who calls himself the Naked Rabbi. Named Rabbi Seacher and his horrifying little wife, who's also a rabbi, and they instigate. There's this kind of SPLC wannabe society that actually is getting federal funding, I believe.
Of course.
called Love Lives Here, but I would say this, and granted, I'm in a different position because the vast majority of you are not open about these ideas, and I totally support that. I think that we need people living their lives. We need people having families, making money. Not everyone's going to do this right now. I think at some point, everyone needs to be open about these ideas. But I did feel like I waged successful ideological warfare against them by effectively turning everything they said against them. So they had this. They were talking about literally creating a anti-hate resolution where it would be illegal to do business with me. So if I went to someone's store and tried to buy something, it would be like, no, that's against the verboten. And then they talked about that for a week, and they decided, no, we obviously can't do that. So let's do a diversity resolution. And I was basically ignoring the thing. And I didn't want to talk to anyone. This was making my life very uncomfortable. But I kind of thought to myself, and I don't want to be too offensive here, but I thought to myself, all right, what do they want me to do? What is the normal white guy going to do? The normal white guy is going to be like, diversity sucks. Fuck that. I hate you. And I was like, but what would a Jew do? Like, I don't mean that in an insulting way at all. Like, how could you flip this thing around in a kind of insidious fashion? And so I said, I embrace your, they had a pro-diversity resolution. I said, well, I embrace your resolution. I am very proud that you have taken this stand. I will accept your apology. I think that is actually, I would say, a little minor victory. It was kind of a terrible point in my life because I was being attacked by everyone on all sides. But I think we need to be strategists in this way. We kind of want to think about, don't do what they want you to do. They want you to do something. There are ways that you can flip things around. And yes, it is disingenuous. I was obviously being disingenuous, but that's how they operate. So I think there are ways that we can kind of fuck with them like that.
Okay.
I think that most of us were liberals before we got here, and I think that if you're a young person in Europe or America and you're not a liberal, there's definitely something very different about you. And nonetheless, we're here right now. And my question is, how do you know when encountering one of these people whether you should reason with them or whether you should just mock them?
I would err on the side of mocking them. but I don't know. I guess you can just it's you can pick up on certain things because there are certain ways you can get at them. Like you can basically take some of their narratives and just point out that, like, you know, the most basic one is sort of like why what is wrong with, you know, white people having their own culture and identity, or even like if we oppress everybody so badly, wouldn't it be better just to separate? You know, I mean, look at all the horrible things. It's not really accurate historically, although we have done horrible things in the past, but, you know, so is everybody. So, like, whatever. But, you know, you can spin that, like, look, if it's so terrible to be around us, which it must be. I mean, obviously, everyone can't stand us. They don't want to be anywhere near us. So, you know, you could try that. I don't know. I think it just really depends on the level of how deep in their own ideology the person is. Like, there's a lot of people out there that are non-ideological, and I actually think that they can be convinced fairly easily. Ideological people are actually good just as foils, I think.
And don't you think, despite my talk was all about, you know, idealism, and, you know, becoming things, but don't you think at some level it's kind of genetically determined? Like, you can more or less look at someone and know, like, I could actually talk to this person. Like, he has a soul. There's somewhere in there. See people, and it's kind of like, all right, let's move on.
You can't really put your finger on it, but you can tell by, you know, demeanor, body language, and things like that, whether or not somebody's...
Well, we've had people that hated us or sending us, like, hate mail and calling us all these horrible things, and they've come back 2 years later, you're right, and they're, like, hardcore extremists on the right. So, I mean, it's happening. Like I say, once that switch flips, it's a spiritual experience. Like, I think of this as church. And a lot of white people, I mean, a lot of us have been outcasts, so once we get together, it's like, wow, there's a power when all these white people get together in this room like this, you know, it's like a temple. And once people experience that, they don't want to walk away from that.
Hi, I'm not really sure when I crossed over in this realm, but ever since I have, I've been trying to find ways of reaching out to people in my area that share my sentiments. I mean, I have a lot of friends that I don't even open up to in the slightest bit about, you know, what I believe and what I think, because every time I have, it's always ended badly. Because, you know, they think, because I think A, I must think B. So I was just wondering if you had any ideas on how people in different parts of the country, like, for example, I'm in Boston, and it's very difficult to find people with my sentiments up there, but how they could maybe find people in their area and connect with them to share ideas and, you know, maybe kind of organize and do things that are productive.
Yeah, I mean, that's really one of the most important questions that there is right now, I think, at this stage of you know, where we're at, to connect with people, to get together, to meet. And, well, I can just speak for myself here and what we're doing here, but we're involved in trying to build a social networking site right now. We've initiated the process of doing that. And, you know, it won't be the end-all, be-all, you know, network where people connect, obviously, but it's a tremendously important step to get people wherever they are in the world, really, in the Western world or wherever, to find each other and to connect. And you know, in some cases, it's for friendship, finding partners, you know, play dates for the kids or whatever it might be. You know, there's
it's called Fashbook.
Hey, I own that. I own that domain.
Oh, really?
I'm not even joking.
Oh, that's funny.
There will be a site at some point. I haven't found good software yet. But, I mean, we actually provide that service on our website. There are, first of all, there's some guys from Massachusetts here. So I don't know if you knew that, but maybe now you can make introductions or whatever. Yeah. But we have if you go to our forum on our site, we do have a section that is specifically for meeting people. It's the standard pool party section where we meet up for pool parties. Really, they're just people having beers. That's a kind of an in-joke. But it's been successful. And then we have a thread where people post about gatherings that they've had. And, you know, it's like if it's as little as two people, that's great. But they've gone from like two up to 10. And basically, the idea there is just reforming a counterculture. Like a little mini subculture of people that don't have to feel alone and isolated, and, you know, there are, you know, people in their hometowns, and they might just not have known them yet, and so we got to get them connected. So I would look there. I know there's people from your area,
and the URL for that is
forum.therightstuff.biz.
So to prefix my question, I can offer myself as somebody who's been convinced by your work. In 2008, I was voting for Obama and chastising people for not being pro-abortion enough. And here I am. And I think the biggest thing that affected me was just realizing that the media relied on narratives that didn't relate to the real world. And they were not in my interests. And I took my own side, as you say. And I think my question is more of just a news item. But I'm sure you're all aware of the police officer that body slammed that girl in, and of course he was fired. But there's a sort of interesting counter narrative there that goes against the media narrative, in that the about 100 students walked out of class in his favor, and I think, and that's a case of him, of those students taking their own side, because they're there to learn. That girl on the phone is not, and the media doesn't care about them. They care about pushing their narrative. So I was just wondering what you thought about that. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, if students had left on that woman's behalf, that would have been the headline, effectively. Yeah. Oh, yeah. But students leave on the cop's behalf, and it's, you know, buried or not mentioned at all.
I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't get disciplined for that, too. Yeah. Like, if they weren't all suspended or something like that for that kind of thing. Because I didn't even know about that. That's good. I'm happy to hear it. And, you know, I think when it comes to liberals, I think one of the things that, you know, we talked all about the sort of the perverse, how high trust has been perverted to create this, you know, self-attacking form of altruism. But, you know, I think fundamentally liberals want high trust society. They want to trust their neighbors. They want to contribute to the commons, to public goods. They want to share with the community. And they just, you can't do that with diversity. And if you can get that, if you have an honest person, it's an honest liberal that's a friend, if you can get that through your head, then you'll just convert them and be like, look, we can have we can have socialized health care. We can have green parklands that are preserved. We can have all of these things. But if we have it in a diverse society, it's just going to be turned against us. So we need to just have a society for us, that all these institutions are there for us.
First, I want to express my gratitude to someone that couldn't be here today, whose handle is Misogynist Chomsky, that paid for two full price tickets for myself and another millennial after only a single Skype call. You'd never met him before, never talked to him or anything. He expressed...
let me interject real quick just on that note. I've met a couple of people like this. These are people who are making money, they're successful, but they're totally on the same page with us. And people are doing things like this now. Like, I'm not trying to take away anything from misogynist Chomsky. But he's not alone. Like, this kind of thing is happening. And I think a lot of those people who would just be, you know, looking at these sites at 2 a.m. and not telling their wife what they're doing and not connecting with anyone, I think it's slowly changing. It's all anecdotally, but it's really slowly changing.
Absolutely. So anyways, he expressed the kind of trust and in-group altruism that is necessary for our movement to succeed. So I want to ask the panel, one, what do you think we can do to promote more of this in-group trust, and as Kevin MacDonald articulated, suppress this individualism, or what I might call pathological individualism, within our movement, and how can people start? And secondly, on a totally different note, should we be doing more to build a coalition of groups that can cooperate in specific instances and pressure points to quicken the overthrow of the hostile Western elite? I'm talking about specifically groups that have little in common except for their opposition to the globalist hostile Western elite.
Well, I think in terms of, what is it, suppressing individualist egalitarianism?
Altruistic individualism.
Altruistic individualism. We might have to just bludgeon these people. but I'm kind of serious. Like, people are who they are. I mean, I think it's a really a question of who leads society. I mean, Kevin MacDonald, when we did a podcast on, there was on a lot of these topics that he talked about today, and the origin of the white race.
It's a kind of like a metaphor of, you need different, there's a tripartite society. You need different aspects of society. You need people who work. You need people who pray. You need people who are the kind of egalitarian types who make the Rice Krispie treats at your church and keep everyone in line. They play a role, but you also need that Aryan type, that warrior mentality, the commander. And if you don't have some of those parts, it's not like you're 10% less effective or something. The whole thing just breaks down. Pathologically altruistic people, they cannot lead society. They cannot be commanding society, period. It doesn't mean that they're useless or something like that. I mean, in some situations, they could be wonderful. But I just think when we lack that, the certain kind of Aryan mentality at the top of society, dictating things, not being consensual, not really using their will to inform society, society breaks down. So it really is like a wheelbarrow where you take off a wheel. It's not like it's 10% less effective or 30% less effective. It doesn't work at all. It just can't function. I think that's our society in general. We have all these components that might be beneficial in themselves or beneficial in other contexts, but they're ruling society, and they just become evil.
Well, I think that what Dr. McDonald said this morning was very interesting about the formation of a moral community, and I think that's the most powerful thing that they have, because these people that are pathologically altruistic and like they follow like exactly what the liberal line is, exactly what they're supposed to think and feel, and welcome the refugees and gay marriage and everything else, like they're correct on everything. They're not, like you said, they're not leaders. They'll respond to the opinions of high-status individuals. And right now, high-status individuals is the current media, the current political climate, educators, people in academia, etc. They're the ones that are forming the moral consensus that these people are then acting on. So we just need to, one of the main ways that we've undermined ourselves in the past is basically being perceived as low-status individuals. So we need to put ourselves out there as high-status individuals, people to be taken seriously. I mean, we love to troll, but also when we present, you have to, like, Richard is a pretty cleaned up looking guy. I mean, that's good. Like, you don't want to be, we know what we're talking about. But so basically, if you present as high status and your opinion as a high status opinion, you'll actually break some of their conditioning. And that's what we need to do, because there's always going to be followers, and they just have to be following the right people. And those people are followers.
Well, actually, to the first point there as well, I just want to mention look at what Golden Dawn has done in Greece, for example, of really being out there on the ground and helping people. I mean, that crisis that they experienced, that's an excellent opportunity to build trust and to get a hold of people that are going to be loyal, and to use that in your advantage to that. And not just because you're sly, because you're doing it because you really believe in helping your people. So those kinds of opportunities are really important to jump on, that show that we are there to help each other out, right? That's what it's all about. So, yeah.
It's about doing the work too and learning self-sacrifice, As libertarians, it's always all for me, all for me, just individualistic all the time. But now I always think of, what can I do today for my people? How am I going to make a difference? How am I going to reach people? And to make it an obsession, make it like a religion every day. Because there's so many people I see that are pro-white that are lazy. They're sitting around. They're not working out. They're not getting buff. They're not learning skills. They're dressing like slobs. It's like,
I mean, really, you people.
Get your act together. What kind of fascist are you, So.
All right. I have a quick comment. First, I want to really thank A, Kevin McDonald, who's here, and B, Goy Enoch, because you guys have changed my life. I was taught to hate America. I love America. I love white America because we are good people. And we deserve to be the best we can possibly be forever. So that's the first comment. The second comment is, I've come over specifically to this event from Belgium, which is kind of far, because I felt that something was happening on the internet. We've also got, I think, Roosh over here, who's a got a website on dating, I think. And it's a mainstream website. Or it's got a non-political website. It's not non-political audience. And he's done a lot to promote Kevin MacDonald's work. And that's a real litmus test, because you see people, all the independent websites now are basically talking about us or converting to us. And so I think we're winning the culture war, at least on that somewhat unscientific, anecdotal level. And I wanted your thoughts on what are the next steps in winning the culture war. Thanks.
Well, I think we, media, entertainment, fashion, arts. We need to start getting our artists together and start building our network. You know, we've had some people approach us that want to help us expand. And so we're thinking of ways to do that, to hire more people, to create more content and make it a 24/7 kind of thing. So entertainment, news, different shows, that's where it's got to go next. Because we don't own the media, and that's where everyone is programmed, you know?
You know, I think it was Alex Kurtigich who really stressed this, and I think he really changed how I think about so many things. I think he informed things that I said today, and I said in other situations. We're not gonna win by burying people with IQ scores. Because, you know, art and passion and dreams, those can, IQ scores will go up in smoke really quickly in the face of good music. And that sounds almost anti-intellectual or banal, but it's absolutely true. You know, data, empiricism, the truth, these things are really overrated. If we could win, and it doesn't even have to be us. It's not like, I think a lot of the, sometimes the religious right will create their own movies. And I think they've gotten actually a lot better at it, but generally speaking, these are real stinkers. But you know, it's better, we shouldn't do that. If we try to create, you know, our action adventure saga, it would suck, I'll be honest, because we don't have the resources. But what we need to do is really influence these people who are doing it. And you know, can we influence Christopher Nolan to make a popular movie that weirdly kind of touches on our themes? That, and I think he's actually done that on multiple occasions already, but can we do it more? I think that kind of thing is so powerful, and that is really what our movement has to be aiming at. I mean, I'm not against, in a way, talking about science. We publish, I mean, I myself have published stuff that could be called, you know, scientific, you know, truth kind of thing, but that shouldn't be our goal. I just think our goal really should be to influence the people who are going to change culture.
How about the long-term goal also, though? I mean, look at Hollywood, how that started. They did, like, you know, Nickelodeon peep shows in New York before they had to flee to, you know, Los Angeles when they were chased by, who was it again they invented? Edison, right? He was behind the movie technology. But the point there is that, you know, they built something up that wasn't that great in the beginning. It kind of sucked. So we have to think long term as well. We have to begin starting things now, even if they're not that awesome. At least do them. You know, whatever you do, try to get into something, a field, or and just do it and get better at it and be consistent and do it over time, so that eventually you know, something great will come out of that, or those talented individuals that already do stuff in Hollywood, when they get disenfranchised, they have somewhere to go to. So the groundwork has to be laid now, I think, on so many different levels.
All right, gentlemen, we're being too philosophical, so we're going to the lightning round. Okay. Questions, make them short, punchy. Answers, make them punchy as well. So if I start extrapolating at length, just hit me over the head. Yeah, so let's go into the lightning round.
Okay, so I'll say that I appreciate the work that all four of you do. And my question or thought experiment is, how much of non-white immigration, primarily into Europe, has been increased because of what you could call progressive imperialism, like the British hiring Gurkhas, the French trying to teach Algerians their language, trying to carry out the white man's burden? And how much of this entitlement that immigrants feel has been caused by our efforts to try to bring civilization to them?
Tons of it.
Yeah, I mean, we know that the current crisis in Europe is directly the result of U.S. foreign policy. I mean, that's not a mystery. So, and then the awful policy combined with the entitlement that these people are taught to have when they come in to Europe,
foreign policy, which is run by AIPAC, by the way, and not American interests.
Yeah, we know obviously. we know who runs foreign policy.
Yeah, the teachers' unions
and the Amish.
So I'm a total Trump supporter. I jumped on the Trump train about, you know, I guess when he announced his candidacy. And I've seen some Trump supporters here as well. I'm just curious everyone's thoughts on his candidacy and what he's doing, how he's bringing up some of these very important topics to us, to our community.
I'll be really quick. I guess I'm a Trump skeptic. I think it's a bit ridiculous for people to believe that this one man, through his hugeness, is going to make America great again. However, I love Trump, and I think it's hilarious because he is delegitimizing the system. He is delegitimizing our enemies. He's delegitimizing conservatives and Republicans. So I find Trump fascinating, not because of Trump himself. I find Trump fascinating for what's going to come after Trump. And I think he really is opening up space, and I think that's great.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that we owe some of our growth to his campaign. Yeah. And he's basically he's saying things that you're not supposed to say, and he can say them because he's got $10 billion. And so that's good, and that's great. I mean, whether or not I think he's going to save America or even get elected, I doubt it. But, you know, he's opened up Pandora's box that they're not going to be able to close again. And the other thing he's done is his rhetoric is very different than any other politician, left or right, in that he actually frames all of his points, whether you agree with them or not, in terms of what's good for America. And that, like, whatever you have, your conceptions of what America is and all that, is different. We haven't heard that in like 50 years, where someone's like, what's good for us as, you know, we're going to frame our policy around what's good for us, not like, oh, how are we going to help these people and how are we going to solve this conflict in the Middle East and I mean all that crap. So and he gets lambasted for that. And I think people are genuinely a little bit confused because they've never heard that before.
All right. Last question, then we're going to wrap it up.
I'm curious that when Western nations each comprise 15 languages, 15 races, 15 mindsets, how on the earth are Western countries going to conduct foreign policy? I mean, is it possible for a viziparous society to have a foreign policy? And how do we know who our enemies are? How do we know to defend our own interests when we have a large Muslim population? Is Islamism still our enemy? We have a large Jewish population. Are we still allied forever with Israel? I foresee that as an unsolvable quandary for a diverse nation.
You know, I think Sam Dixon actually said it best. If we were going to try to destroy this current order, I'm not sure we would be so bold as to do the things that it is doing to itself. So we really have to have that kind of Leninist mentality, because I think it's really I think that is the healthiest mentality. If we try to save the system, you know, let's keep saving America, we're going to be like conservatives. We're going to be depressed. We're going to be offering half solutions and little tactics that don't solve any of the problem. We've got to think big, and we've got to think beyond the current American empire.
They can't conduct foreign policy already, and we've seen it. Like, they can't do it. They can't even conduct a pro-Israel foreign policy, which is what we all expect. Like, they have no policy. They're completely, like, Putin is consistently stumping Obama. He's making him look like a pussy. And there's nothing, but I'm happy. I don't want him doing anything. Like, he shouldn't be doing anything, because anything he's going to do is stupid. So that's good. And increasingly, there's going to be so many internal contradictions, as the commies say, in the regime, that they're just going to be paralyzed on every issue. You can't be pro-Jewish and pro-Islam at the same time. It doesn't work. But, of course, America has to be.
Yeah. Well, look, this was really a hell of a lot of fun. Thanks for the questions.
Well, folks, we'll be back in just a few days again. We have much more coming up. In the meantime, stay tuned to the website, redicecreations.com and redicereadio.net for more. And of course, if you like what we do and want to hear more, sign up for a membership with us at redicemembers.com for all our full shows, over 1,000 and counting now. All right, we'll speak to you in just a few days. Take care.
Show.